Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
It's good to be here this morning. I just got a picture of Shelley and Elliot at the Golden Gate Bridge. That's where they're this weekend. They went up with on a school work trip with Pepperdine. And so I am here by myself this morning, but I'm glad to be here with you all. I really enjoyed Cade's reading, and it's Cade, right? That was really neat. Thank you. It's good to be here with you. I was looking forward to having a weekend by myself, and I had mostly that with it was peppered with a bunch of honeydews as for some reason we have a dog, a cat, three rabbits, and Shelley likes to take care of the birds in our neighborhood. So I had lots of things that I was doing. Plus, we had an undesired animal visitor in our garage. So I was trying to figure out how it was getting in and how to get rid of it. So I was working on that this weekend. And just as Shelley and Elliot were getting ready to leave on Friday, I get a text from Joel saying if I would come by on Saturday evening and pick him up and take him to the valley where he could purchase a car. So that was kind of exciting that he'll be 20 tomorrow, that my 20-year-old son is purchasing his first car. But it was right in the middle of that day that I was planning to just sort of have on my own. So I'm a little grumpy. And I thought I would start off with a confession. I don't know if you realize this, and I want to say this up front that I have come to learn the value of human contact, of human touch in church and family life, especially. So I appreciate it when I have the opportunity to hug a brother or sister, to shake hands, but I thought I'd just let you know, and I'm not asking you to treat me differently. I just, just so you know, I'm not a hugger, okay? So in the context, like I got to hug Jackie this morning, and that really means a lot. It means a lot, and it's a sign that I very much care about and am willing to touch people here. But generally speaking, especially in places where like at work and things like that, I'm not one of those people who like to hug. And what I've discovered through the years is that by telling people this, it's like putting chum in the water for huggers. So you tell people you're not a hugger, and all of a sudden the huggers are like, wait, you haven't had my hug. And they just, I worked with a guy for a couple of years in my office who, he was a hugger, and there was just no way I could escape him. And because he didn't report to me, I couldn't fire him. So I had to figure out how to navigate that on a regular basis, this whole hugging thing. I remember when I first started teaching, somehow I let out to my students that I was not a hugger. This is back when I was in Michigan and I was teaching. And the next thing I know, one semester, one day, I was in the cafeteria, and all of a sudden, a student just walked up to me, and I don't even know who this student was. He just hugged me, and out of the blue, and then walked away. Somebody had put him up to it. And that's like the very worst hug that you can imagine. Now, a few days later, I think a couple weeks later, I'd figured out who that student was, and I had figured out who had put him up to it. So I was speaking to the whole college at a chapel service, and I specifically called those two people out, and then I gave them an awkward hug in front of everybody. But I say this because it's going to help you understand how I read this particular passage. Cade read the heart of the passage where Jesus tells a parable, or a portion of what really is working in that passage, what it's about, is when he tells this parable. But the passage is this larger story. And, well, let me just start off by reading the very beginning of it. We're in chapter 7 of the Gospel of Luke, and we're going to start in verse 36. When one of the Pharisees invited Jesus to have dinner with him, he went to the Pharisee's house and reclined at the table. A woman in that town who lived a sinful life learned that Jesus was eating at the Pharisee's house. So she came there with an alabaster jar of perfume, and she stood behind him at his feet, weeping. And she began to wet his feet with her tears. Then she wiped them with her hair, kissed them, and poured perfume on them. Move that down a little bit. All right, so having told you that I do not like human contact, you can imagine as I read this story just how uncomfortable this story makes me. Because we have a person who is not just standing behind you, and I don't know, again, you know, I don't know if you how you like that when somebody's just sort of standing behind you. In this case, Jesus is reclining. We'll talk a little bit about the setting in a second. Jesus is reclining, so his feet are sort of out behind him, and there's this woman standing, and she's crying. So that's already uncomfortable, but you know, okay. But then the next thing you know, she's crying and her tears are falling on his feet, and then she's falling down at his feet, and then she is rubbing her tears, the water of her tears, on his feet and taking her hair and rubbing the tears on his feet, trying to dry them, I suppose, and then she's kissing his feet. And then she's pouring perfume on his feet. So even if you do like human contact, I'm pretty sure you don't like this kind of contact. And if you do, I don't want to hear about it. This is very uncomfortable, right? And I want us to think about this woman whom Luke describes for us. As Jesus is at this dinner, this woman hears, and Luke tells us she is a woman of the city, and she's a sinner. Now, kind of like that line in A Christmas Carol when the narrator tells us that Bob Marley is dead and we have to accept this or the rest of the story doesn't make any sense. We have to start off with this point. We have to accept this one thing, that woman is a sinner. And probably when he says that she was a woman of the city, possibly, quite possibly, this is a euphemism. This is a woman about the city. In other words, more than likely, this is a woman who is a prostitute. So, and the term sinner itself points to this, points to the fact that this is a woman with a lifestyle of sin. Now, when we think about sin and being a sinner, we're all shaped by the text of Romans chapter 3, which says that all have sinned and all have fallen short of the glory of God. And we think, well, then, we're all sinners. But in Jesus' world, in the first century, in Judea, that's not what they meant by the term sinner. They didn't think of everyone as a sinner. In fact, I can guarantee you that this Pharisee, his name is Simon, who invited Jesus into his house, would not have thought of himself as a sinner. He would have thought of himself as in need of God's grace, sure, but not as a sinner. When we use the term sinner, when the gospel uses the term sinner, it's describing somebody who is involved in a pervasive lifestyle of living outside the bounds of what is called righteous living. Somebody who has, who is doing things that are clearly wrong, but not just in a little ways, or not just as many of us do, struggling with sin, but in the sense that this is her lifestyle. And as we've come to understand, and I think they had this understanding then as well, there are pervasive structures of sin and sort of. Deep societal structures that cause this to happen, that force people into lifestyles that they would not have otherwise chosen, but they can't escape. And I think it's worth, in other contexts, to talk about what those deep structures are, but I want to make clear that Luke does not say that there was injustice in the society and it caused this person to do something that she didn't want to do. He makes very clear that this person is a sinner. This person is a sinner, and that's one thing he tells us. But notice another thing that he tells us. When she hears that Jesus is at this dinner, she rushes to see him. But before she leaves, do you see what she did before she goes to see Jesus? What did she grab? An alabaster jar of perfume, probably an alabaster bottle. And alabaster is a precious stone that's been, it's very fragile, and inside of it would have been very expensive perfume. So here's this woman who has this expensive perfume. It's possible that this is part of her dowry, that she was given this as sort of her from her family. It's also possible that she's received it through the means of her prostitution, that she's purchased this. Who knows how she has it? But she grabs that perfume, and that tells us something. That tells us when that woman goes to the dinner. And she's not invited, right? She goes to that dinner. She's not going just to watch. She's going with a plan to do something. She is going, right, with this bottle of perfume with the intent of doing something. So she's standing behind Jesus, and she's weeping. And she, her tears are falling down. Next thing you know, she's falling down and she's at the feet of Jesus, and her tears are on his feet, and she's wiping his feet with her hair. The fact that her hair is down and the fact that she starts kissing his feet, this also would not have been something that people typically did. Sometimes, you know, there are things in the Bible and we in the 21st century read that and think, wow, what's going on in there? I don't know anything about that. And then somebody like me who's a college professor will come along and say, well, you know, if you knew about the first century, this is pretty much standard custom. So, and then we'd say, oh, okay, well, they were different then, all right. It wasn't standard custom in the first century for somebody to be stooped down kissing somebody's feet in the middle of a dinner party. I mean, certainly not any kind of dinner party that anyone would have wanted to go to. This was a shocking thing. And that allows us then to sort of see this scene unfold, but now we want to step over and look at it from the perspective of the Pharisee whose house this is and whose dinner this is. Simon, his name is, we hear it later on. He invited Jesus to this dinner, and from the indications of what Luke describes, it's a special kind of dinner. It's a banquet, or in Greek, what's called a symposium. It's a kind of dinner that happened a lot in the Greco-Roman world, where you would have a person who would bring others to his table, right? And they would recline. And that reclining is part of this special banquet. They would sit on three sides, and they'd have lie basically, and they would lean in. I'm not sure if I can show you how they would do it without hurting myself. But anyway, they would lie on the ground, and they would have cushions to sort of prop them up, and they'd have a table, and they'd be there. And then the idea of this is actually that there would be people coming and watching this meal. This is before we had television and theater. We had dinner parties, and people would come and they would watch the dinner parties, and they'd listen to the conversations, and it would be an evening of entertainment. And for the Pharisee, for Simon the Pharisee, this is an opportunity to bring people into his home, to show his beautiful house, to show the kind of guests that he could bring in. And it was a chance for him to establish his honor in the community, right? So, and Jesus, this prophet who is going around proclaiming this message, this is a good get, right? When you're trying to throw together a big party and you want to bring somebody in that's going to draw attention, that's going to have exactly the effect with the sinful woman, although maybe not her entire, I'm pretty sure Simon wasn't trying to get her to come to this party or people like her, but it would let the whole city know, hey, look what's going on at Simon's house. Jesus of Nazareth is going to be there. So Simon is excited. He's got this beautiful dinner. He's got, you know, he's put out all the stops to make it just a lovely evening to establish for everyone just how great an evening can be at Simon's house. And then all of a sudden, this woman breaks through all the barriers and all the boundaries, and she's standing behind, you know, and you could just see Simon watching, watching this woman as she stands behind Jesus. And then, can you imagine the expression on his face when he sees her kneeling with her hair down? The hair being down in the Jewish world, like, for again, here's the difference. For today, if your hair is down, you're just wearing your hair that way, and we don't question it, we don't think anything about it. But in the Jewish world, to have your hair down like this is something that women would only do in the privacy of their bedrooms. And the only people that would see their hair down would be their husbands. It was a kind of signal that would send to, if you saw it out in public, it would be akin to being naked. And it's very suggestive. So here we are at this party. This woman has her hair down, and she's touching Jesus' feet and kissing his feet and pouring perfume. And you could just see the expression on Simon's face, right? Aghast at what's happened. This beautiful dinner party that he's planned, this opportunity to show his guests how honorable he is, and this woman has come in and is ruining things. In Simon and in the sinful woman, we see two people and we see two worlds. We see two people who are very different when it comes to what they think about their appearance, when it comes to what they think about boundaries, religious boundaries, cultural boundaries, what the ancients would have called purity, when it comes to the demonstration of or the expression of emotions, when it comes to whether or not they're in control, when it comes to status. There are two completely different worlds, right? The woman is not concerned about her appearance. She's not thinking, what are people going to say about me tomorrow, right? She is caught up in her moment. She's not concerned. She's lost control. She's her emotions have gotten the better part of her. She's not worried about her status and what this will mean for her. And Simon is worried about all of those things. Simon is worried about what people will think about the fact that this happened at his house. He's worried about the fact that he went through all this effort to have this great evening and he's lost control of it. He's worried, right, about his status and about the fact that the party that was supposed to embellish him, supposed to speak to his to his honor, is on the verge of dishonoring his guests, his other guests that he's invited that are reclining with Jesus. And himself, as the spectators, the crowd, starts to talk and word gets out, you can't believe what happened at Simon's house. But the main distinction between these two people, the main fault line between them, is Jesus. How they understand Jesus. Simon invited Jesus into his home because he wanted to show people that he had the clout to get Jesus to come over and that he could pull people in to listen and to be entertained by that evening. Simon brought Jesus into his home in the same way that he would have set up and arranged the furniture and made sure that the menu was precisely the way it should be. It was about controlling his image, his status, and for his purposes. And with the woman, she came, right? When she brought that alabaster jar, she had one intention. She had one goal, and that was to let Jesus know that she loved him. To let Jesus know that she cared for him. She wasn't interested in any of those other things like Simon was. The difference is how they understood Jesus. Speaking of Jesus, we've been talking about the fact that Jesus is at Simon's house and how the woman treated Jesus and how Simon saw the woman, etc. But let's think about Jesus here. And here we get to the portion of the passage. Well, before we do that, look at verse 39. When the Pharisee who had invited Jesus saw this, he said to himself, "If this man were a prophet, He would know who is touching him and what kind of woman she is, that she is a sinner. I can't help but think that when Luke tells us this story, he's smiling and laughing a little bit. Just think about the logic of the Pharisee. If this man were a prophet, he would know what kind of woman this is. I don't think it takes a prophet to understand who this woman is. I don't think you need to be somehow specially connected with God. Simon understood who this woman was. Anybody would understand, with her hair down and with her alabaster jar and her making such a scene, what kind of woman this is. Clearly, right? So this idea that if Jesus were a prophet, he would know, that's really Simon's way of saying, if Jesus were somebody I would view as a prophet, he would know who this is. But then, verse 40, Jesus answered him, "Simon, I have something to tell you." At this point, for those of you who remember the original Star Wars films and may remember the Return of the Jedi, there's a scene in Return of the Jedi where the Rebel Alliance is about to attack the Imperial forces at the moon of Endor. And as they get there, they discover that the Imperial forces are waiting for them. And the line that comes out from one of the leaders of the Rebels, Admiral Akbar, is, "It's a trap." And that's become a meme on the internet. If you just Google, if you do a Google search for "it's a trap," you'll find a video clip of Admiral Akbar saying, "It's a trap." That's what I wish at this point. When Jesus says, "Simon, I have something to tell you," somebody should tell Simon, "It's a trap. Don't take the bait. Don't listen to him. Ignore him, because it's not going to go well." But nobody does that. And Simon says, "Tell me, Lord. Tell me, teacher." At that point, Simon's taken the bait. His fate is sealed. He probably said this because at the kind of dinner party that he envisioned, the entertainment was, as I told you, the conversation. And he thought, well, maybe Jesus is going to salvage the evening. Maybe we're going to have a lovely conversation, or a philosophical conversation, or a conversation about the law. Something that will put it back on my footing, on my ground. So he says, "So yeah, please tell me, what do you have to say, Jesus?" And at that point, Jesus tells him the parable that Cade read earlier. I'll just repeat it here. It's not a long parable. Verse 41. Two people owed money to a certain moneylender. One owed him 500 denarii and the other 50. Neither of them had the money to pay him back, so he forgave the debts of both. Now, which of them will love him more? This is a very simple parable. Jesus is known to tell much longer ones, so mercifully, if you're already looking at the clock wondering when this is going to end, it's not a long parable. But in its simplicity, it says something quite audacious. A moneylender had two people who owed him money, and he chose, because they couldn't pay him back, to forgive their debt. A moneylender forgiving debts. That's not a good moneylender, right? That's that's like a car salesperson who doesn't sell cars. Or an accountant who doesn't work with money, right? It's work with numbers. It doesn't make sense. Why would a moneylender forgive debts? And yet he does. And in that concept, we begin to see just the shimmer of an image of the kind of God that Jesus represents, who doesn't operate the way that we would expect him to operate. A moneylender who does indeed forgive debts. But the main point here is you have two people who owe him. One, 50 denarii, and the other, 500 denarii. What's a denarii? A denarii is a day's wage, effectively. So I did the math, and I think it's something like if you do California's minimum wage that we seem to be going to, I think in Los Angeles it's $15, and you do that certain number of hours a week, and all of that comes up to about $60,000, right, for 500 denarii. And for 50 denarii, it's more like $6,000. So the point is, though, which one of those, the one who was forgiven $6,000, the one who was forgiven $60,000, will love the money lender more? And at that point, we have a couple questions. One is, what an interesting use of terms Jesus has. Which will love him more? Right? Again, we think of love in a way where it's really about emotion and affection and about. But here is this strange understanding of love as a response to forgiveness. And to the forgiveness of debt in particular. Simon's response to this is, well, basically, the power of the parable is that it forces Simon to see something and admit something that he wouldn't admit otherwise, right? By telling a parable here, instead of just simply opening with where Jesus wants to go and where he will go in a moment, he forces Simon to say something that Simon otherwise would not want to say, would not want to admit, right? Jesus says, which would love the moneylender more? Simon replies, I suppose the one who had the bigger debt forgiven. Notice the language, I suppose. It's like hemming and hawing. Well, you know, if I have to answer the question, but in reality, Simon knows that he doesn't want to answer the question. He's reticent to do it because I think he sees what's about to happen. Right? The trap's been sprung. Jesus replies, you have judged correctly. Notice how in this moment we see a transition from Simon being the one sort of orchestrating everything, and now Jesus is the one who is the teacher and who's saying, you have judged correctly. He's grading Simon. And he says, verse 44, then he turned toward the woman and said to Simon, do you see this woman? I love the way that Luke describes the body posture. He turns toward the woman. But I also find this question that he asks Simon to be something somewhat unnerving. Do you see this woman? Simon's going to say, see her? I haven't been able to keep my eyes off this woman since she came in and kneeled down at your feet and was wiping her hair on your feet and kissing your feet and pouring perfume on your feet. Do I see her? Of course I see her. But does he see her? Does he see her for who she is? Does he see her the way that Jesus sees her? Does he see her the way that God sees her? This question scares me because I know that there are 100 times through my typical week where if Jesus was there and he said, Ron, do you see this woman? Or Ron, do you see this person, this man? Do you see this person? I'd have to be honest. And at best, I might say, you mean that annoying person or that crazy person? Or that sinful person? But would I really, really see the people Jesus is pointing out the way that he intends for them to be seen? Do you see the people that God places in your life? The people, even the people that barge into your life, do you see them? Jesus says, Simon, do you see this woman? I came into your house, he says, and you did not give me water for my feet, but she wet my feet with her tears and wiped them with her hair. You did not give me a kiss, but this woman from the time I entered has not stopped kissing my feet. You did not put oil on my head, but she has poured perfume on my feet. Therefore, I tell you, her many sins have been forgiven, as her great love has shown. But whoever has been forgiven little, loves little. You see what he did there? Right? It's not just about the woman, it's about Simon. And it's not just that the woman did these things that Simon didn't do. Right? Simon did not offer a servant to wash his feet. Simon did not pour perfume on his head, anoint his head, which is something, again, in the first century that very well could have and would have happened as a way of just sort of, you know, honoring your guests who come in and they're dirty from the trip, and you give them a chance to have their feet washed and their hair given perfume so that they all smell wonderful and they have a good time and they're relaxed. That's what would have happened. But it's not just that Simon didn't do the basic things of courtesy for Jesus, because for him, getting Jesus into the house wasn't about welcoming Jesus. It was about boosting his image, right? Jesus was just a tool, just something he was using for his own advantage. It's not just that Simon didn't exercise basic hospitality, it's that in every possible way, this woman has gone beyond what Simon would have even thought to have done if Simon were basically courteous. She has lavished Jesus in a way that Simon couldn't even imagine for his most precious of guests. She has truly loved Jesus. Why? Why has she done this? Why has she done all of these things? The woman loved because she was loved and she knew it. The woman is responding to Jesus' love. When she grabbed that alabaster jar, she was going not to just listen to a lovely evening conversation, to stand there and admire from afar. She was going to respond in love to somebody who had loved her, whom she knew had forgiven her of her sins. She was going to do something that nobody would have thought appropriate, right? She was going to act with kind of reckless abandon in loving Jesus. Why? Because she knew that Jesus had loved her with reckless abandon. The fault line, the dividing line here is Jesus and how Simon understood Jesus as somebody to boost his image, to boost his honor, to use for his own advantage, as opposed to the woman who understood Jesus as the lover of her soul, the one who truly cared for her and forgave her. And because she knew who Jesus was and she knew how Jesus loved her, she could love him in the same way. Jesus is here to love us beyond our appearances, to break down or break through our defenses and through our facades. He's here to love us past what we're comfortable being loved, past what we feel we want to we want people to do. He's here to break down our efforts to control our appearances, to establish our status, to let everybody know how special we are. Jesus isn't interested in what our designs, our intentions are. He's here to love us. And if we let him love us, we will respond like this woman. We will love with the kind of reckless abandon. His words to the woman, as this story concludes, he says to her, "Your sins are forgiven." The other guests began to say among themselves, "Who is this who even forgives sins?" And Jesus said to the woman, "Your faith has saved you. Go in peace." These words that Jesus utters to the woman, effectively, "Your great debts are forgiven. Your sins are forgiven. Your faith has saved you." These are words he wishes to utter to Simon. Jesus is not interested in saying that he loves the sinful woman, but he doesn't love Simon. He loves Simon. The problem is Simon won't let Jesus love him. This morning, though, Jesus is here saying to each of us, "Your sins are forgiven. You are released from your great debt." Here's the challenge for us. Do we believe it? Are we willing to accept Jesus' love, his reckless love, his wild love? Are we willing to do that? It's real for us. This morning, Jesus says to us, "Your faith, the faith that brought you here this morning, The faith that brought you here saves you. Trust me. Trust me to take away your sins. Trust me to heal you. Trust me to bring you into the presence of God Almighty, he says. The question is, will we receive that love? And will we let it change us and let it provoke in us the kind of response that provoked in the woman? Will we love Jesus the way he has loved us? Let's consider the words of Jesus as we stand and sing.